K-L-A-V-D-I? Close enough. What about Kiki? K-I-K-I? Yep. Oh, he's got a whole page to himself. Addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, even bank account and routing numbers. Pulling a post-it from Ruby's pad, I snatched a pen. Cell phone, please. There are five of them. Is there a U.S. one? Yes. Give me that one. She read the number and I scribbled it down. Hey, Laurie, take a photo of all that information and text it over to Vic, would you? You trying to catch my murderer? Maybe. I want an executive producer credit. You got it. I gave the phone back to Ruby and turned, walking over and handing the number to Katrina. Call him. She stared at the number and then up at me. Why me? He sees this call is from the sheriff's department. Then he may not answer. She nodded, then punched the number and held on to the phone for a bit before placing it to her ear. After a moment, she started and then spoke. Hello? There was another pause, and I could hear someone speaking on the line. Her response seemed strained. I was hoping to speak with Mr. Kropotkov. Extending my hand, I gestured for her to give me the phone, which she did. This is Absaroka County Sheriff Walt Longmire, and I need to speak with Klavdiy Kropotkov. This is Mr. Kropotkov's personal secretary. Can I help you? The voice sounded familiar. Mr. Weston? Yes. Can I help you, Sheriff? Convenient. Is Mr. Kropotkov there, wherever you are? Sheridan, and no, he's not here. Do you have a number where he can be reached? I can give you some numbers, all of which he most certainly will not answer, or I can contact him myself and have him get in touch with you, if that would suffice. I guess it'll have to. Is this the number you would like him to call? No. I gave him the number of the office and then hung up, figuring if I ever heard back from anybody, it would be a miracle. So how long are you going to give him? I handed Katrina her phone and then turned to Vic and frowned. About an hour, then I'll call Mr. Weston back and impress upon him the importance of the murder investigation in which we're involved. I turned back to Ruby. Bass Townsend? Still resting in his cabin. Katrina put her phone into her purse. The grandson of the man who had the painting? The one in the cabin next to mine? Yep. He seems like a nice man. A suddenly rich man, that's for sure. I studied her. What are your plans? I really don't know. She twisted the expensive rings on her finger. I had no official standing with Philip, so I suppose I'm out on the streets. You might want to contact the Sheridan Sheriff's Department to see when you can go back in the house for your belongings. I will. Did the Count have any family? No. I'm afraid the creditors would be the only ones picking the bones. Well, I'm sorry for your loss. She gathered her things and headed down the steps. I'd like to stay in touch. I'm curious as to how this is all going to play out. I've got your number, and I promise to keep you in the loop. If you decide to leave the state, I'd appreciate a call. She stared up at me. I'm still a suspect? Nope, just an interested personage. She smiled. I like the sound of that. Watching her go, Vic leaned against the wall by the stairs. Are we going to the veterans' home? 'Cause if we're not, I'm going to go study the options catalog for my new truck. I'm going to the home, but you don't have to. Are you kidding? I wouldn't miss this for the world. Besides, it might be walleye and tater tots or pizza. We live in hope. We'd just started down the steps when the phone rang. Ruby picked up the receiver and simply handed it to me. Absaroka County Sheriff Walt Longmire. Sheriff Carson Brandis's voice rang in my ear with all the finality of the bell on a 10-round bout. All right, get your ass over to aisle 13 in frozen foods. Your buddy Serge Boshirov was found dead up at the rest stop on I-90. Chapter 13. This is the last time I'm ever letting you in my county. I kneeled, studying the dead body, as flies buzzed in the high grass around the mound of flesh that, until recently, had been Serge Boshirov. It's not my fault. You should start your own funeral home, Sheriff Brandis kneeled beside me. You know, keep it in-house. Shot? He nodded curtly. 9mm. Smallest caliber for a man this big. Not in the back of the head, it's not. Vic joined us and watched as Woodson and the DCI crew gridded the scene and gathered evidence into plastic bags. After seeing me, the director of DCI and thwarted fly fisherman walked over in his yellow jumpsuit. Vic looked him up and down. Nice tie, Vic. Pulling his hood back, he lowered his glasses and mask and smiled through his beard at my undersheriff. Thank you, DuPont Tykiem. The yellow is a nice change, he nodded. Keeps us from getting run over sometimes. Vic gestured toward the body. So, he's dead? Through deliberate and diligent detection, we've ascertained that he is indeed dead. Long dead? He looked at her. I'd say about 4 hours. So, right after the interview at the Sheridan jail? Couldn't have been too long after. I got up and turned to Carson, who was still kneeling. You've got security cameras in front of the jail?
Sure do.
Anybody pick him up? I haven't had a chance to look at the footage, but I'll check with the front desk. He glanced around. Kind of isolated over here on the scenic loop. People sometimes walk their dogs, but unless you want to view the Montana border, there really isn't any reason to come this direction. All the services are down the other way. Close range? Woody turned to me. Very. He's got powder burns all over the back of his head. Hell, part of his hair caught on fire, but that might just be because of the amount of hair product. He smiled. Maybe it was Vic. She was with me. Woody shrugged, his yellow hazmat suit crinkling. Back to zero. Looking at the pullout, I could see the dry dirt and gravel seeding to the Johnson grass and thistle. Vehicle tracks? Plenty of passenger cars and pickup trucks, take your pick. He didn't walk here in that amount of time.
No.
So, somebody picks him up and drives him up here and gets him out of the car and then walks up behind him and shoots him in the head. Sounds like the most plausible of scenarios. And he tracks, all of them. Woody nodded. I was afraid you were going to say that. He called over part of his crew. I turned back toward the body. Cell phone? Woody shrugged. Not yet. It should be around here. He was preoccupied with the thing. Turning back to Carson, I mended fences. You don't mind if I take point on this? He gestured toward the dubious surroundings. Be my guest. Just keep me tight in the loop and credit me in the papers. Deal. Taking a few steps to the right, I placed my hands on my hips and stared at the recently departed. It was true that he wasn't a man I particularly liked, but fate had brought him in contact with me, and now he was dead, and that made me partially responsible. Who did he know? Who would he trust? Who would kill him, and why?
Earth to Walt. I turned and looked at her as she smiled. So you're getting pissed, huh?
She stood beside me, towing a tuft of grass. There's always a point where you start taking it personally. I like that part because that's when shit starts happening. And I like when shit starts happening. She turned her face toward me, listening as I clenched my fists like a cinch being tightened on a saddle. So, is shit about to start happening? I believe so. She placed her hands on her hips and joined me in gazing at the dead man. God, I love my chosen profession. We were speeding across a ridge along the Bighorn Mountains that separated it from Lake Des Metes, running through the potential suspects, but not coming up with much more than we already knew. So if we find the painting, we find the killer? Possibly, but if you've got the painting, why kill Serge or the Count for that matter? She lodged her boots on my dash like she always did. Covering your tracks? I always mean to tell you, if we were ever in a crash, the airbags on this thing expand at about 100 miles an hour and are going to drive your kneecaps through your collarbones. I guess my new truck will have airbags, right? She shrugged. Anyway, not with my cat-like reflexes. She turned back toward me, moving her legs and placing her feet in my lap. Anything from DCI on the murder scene and story?
Nope.
Shit.
My thoughts exactly.
How the hell do you get rid of a body like that? Roll it up in a priceless painting? I glanced at her. Just a thought.
We were interrupted when her phone rang with the Philadelphia Eagles fight song.
She fished around to her back pocket and answered, What fresh hell is this?
There was a pause.
He's right here. Hold on.
She made an exaggerated look of shock and then covered the phone.
It's Klavdiy Krovopuskov.
You're kidding.
Sounds like him.
Luckily, there was a truck pull-off where the 18-wheelers
could strap on their chains only a quarter mile ahead, and I took the phone as I eased into the parking area that had a marvelous view of Blacktooth Mountain. Mr. Krovopuskov?
Hello, Sheriff. I hear there has been a terrible accident.
I lowered the windows to let in a little air and switched off the engine.
Well, I'm not so sure it's an accident.
Do you mind if I ask where you are?
Helsinki.
It was a surprisingly good line from about a quarter of the way around the world.
Finland. Yes.
And how long have you been there?
Well, the flight was the night I left your company there in Wyoming.
I see. He laughed.
You sound disappointed.
No, not particularly, but I'm sorry to tell you that two of your associates are possibly dead.
Two?
Yes, Philip Lehman and Serge Bushirov.
Who?
The Count's bodyguard and driver.
The fat one.
He was rather large, yes.
How was he killed?
Shot.
Conrad Wessin informed me Philip had been killed. Was he shot too?
We're not sure. There was a silence on the crystal clear line.
You think I had something to do with this?
Not necessarily, but you did know both victims.
Not really. Philip was a business associate, and I did not know this man Bushirov at all.
Funny, he claimed to know you.
A lot of people claim to know me, Sheriff.
A moment passed, and I was acutely aware of the tenuous thread that connected me to this man, fully aware that all he had to do was hang up, and I would never have the opportunity to speak to him again.
This is a murder investigation, yes?
Yep.
Would you like me to come back to Wyoming?
I laughed.
I don't think that's necessary at this point. I can't be there in 12 hours. Where is the nearest airport from your town?
Well, Durant has an airport.
How long is the runway?
I honestly don't know.
Never mind, I will find out.
The phone went transatlantic dead in my hand, and I gave it back to Vic.
What?
He'll be here in 12 hours.
From Finland?
I nodded, started the truck, and pulled back into the highway, as she postulated. Do you ever get the feeling that there are people out there who are living lives that we know absolutely nothing about? I'm pretty certain of it.
So he was flying to Helsinki when both of these individuals were killed and has an ironclad alibi?
So it would appear.
Then why is he coming back?
I have no idea.
The borscht thickens.
When we pulled into the soldiers and sailors' home, Spooky, by the Classics 4, was blaring into the empty parking lot from the speakers above. Taking the closest parking spot, I got out and stretched my back, feeling a stitch in my side.
You know, I might just start hanging around in this parking lot when I get my new truck.
I sighed.
Why, do you not like this music?
I started toward the glass doors of the main building. It reminds me of things.
Like what?
Like the Tet Offensive. Carol Williams was waiting for us in the entryway. I've got them corralled in the library section of the recreation room, but they're restless. I'll try not to say anything that might touch them off. We don't want to stampede. She smiled and led us into the interior of the building, where we wound our way down the corridors, finally making a left by the ramp next to the pool table, which led us into the open area where I'd been before. The four flagships were in field presentation, the major branches of the armed forces sitting in their wheelchairs with their arms collectively folded. They ignored me with Talmudic concentration.
Gentlemen, we didn't do anything. Clifton unfolded his arms, but then, with nothing else to do with them, adjusted his boonie hat.
Well, for starters, what do you suppose I think you did?
Stole that painting.
Delmar blurted it out before realizing what he'd said, and then glanced at the others before slamming his mouth shut. Kenny turned to him.
Damn it, Delmar!
Trying to hide a smile, I addressed all of them.
And what painting is that?
They tightened their folded arms in a collective wall of silence.
All right, guys, let me tell you what I think I know, and then you better start filling in the blanks, or else.
Or else what?
Ray fixed me with a defiant glare.
I'll bust all of you.
As near as I can tell, the painting in question is the property of the United States government, and theft thereof is in direct violation of federal law, which means I can charge all of you as accessories in a conspiratorial act on a federal level akin to terrorism. Now that means I'll be dishonorably discharging all of you,
and you'll be relieved of your military benefits. Vic, having walked past them to stare out the window, turned to glance at me with a wide-eyed look, fully aware that this was an inordinate and monumental display of horseshit. Figuring I needed to ratchet it up yet another notch, I turned to Carol. "What's on the menu tonight?" She fixed them with a hard stare.
"Pizza."
The four horsemen looked at one another, torn at the thought of being deprived. Navy grumbling at Air Force.
"I told you it wouldn't work. Shut up, Kenny." "You shut up, Ray."
The airman grunted. "He was always talking about that damn painting, but how it was going to be his retirement." He gestured to the area around them, like he wasn't already retired here in God's waiting room. "Tell me about the painting. You've seen it?" Clifton grumbled a response.
"Oh, we called bullshit on it so many times that he finally hauled it out and showed it to us."
Kenny added, "With some help."
"What do you mean?"
"That thing was huge, and with all of us in wheelchairs, it was kind of unwieldy, if you catch my drift."
"So who helped?"
None of them spoke. "Gentlemen, if you don't cooperate with me on this, I will make sure that you never see another pizza as long as you live."
"Magic Mike Bursaw."
"Semper Fi." I thought about the second-floor window, plastered with stickers, and the speakers blaring 60s music over the parking lot. "The disc jockey?"
"Yeah, him. He's a big guy and could carry the thing."
Delmar the Marine rolled his chair backward and pointed toward a large event table.
"Late one night, Charlie Lee got Mike to wrestle the thing out here and unroll it on the table, rolled the damn thing right off the end of the table, in fact, and started off down the hallway."
Navy nodded.
"Mike's big, but he ain't real handy."
Army added his 2 cents. "Deaf as a post." Air Force affirmed.
"Oh, that damn rock and roll music. Or working the decks on an aircraft carrier and didn't wear his ear protection."
I sighed as they collectively nodded.
"When was this?"
"Vietnam."
I sighed. "No. When was the last time you saw the painting?"
"About a month ago when the Russians showed up."
Navy added,
"He's deaf-mute. Now how the hell did working on an aircraft carrier rob him of speech?"
Ignoring him, I tried to get the conversation back on the rails. "Then what happened to the painting?" Air Force shrugged.
"What do you mean, then what? Mike rolled it up and carried it back to Charlie Lee's room."
"And that was the last you saw of it?"
"Yeah."
Marine Corps spoke up.
"We tried to get him to cut it up."
Vic glanced at me again and then addressed the man.
"What?"
"Well, it was a big old thing, so we thought he could cut it up and share it. You know, give us all a piece for our retirement."
I smiled and massaged the bridge of my nose with a thumb and forefinger. "Did he happen to tell you how he came into possession of the painting?" Clifton took the lead.
"Said he saved it from a fire in Texas.
Fort Bliss in 46?
Something like that."
"So he stole it?"
"No, he didn't."
I said nothing and waited as the old soldier pulled at his lower lip.
"He told me about it after he showed us the damn thing, about how he worked in the commissary connected to the officers' club, washing dishes in the kitchen, when the place caught on fire. He said it was bad, an old wood building that went up like rice paper and kindling. The CO was a real asshole and ordered them into this thing to try and save the silverware and whatnot, but nobody said anything about the painting. Anyway, Charlie Lee went back in 3 times, the next to last time hauling one of his buddies out by covering the two of them up with the only thing that was handy, the painting." Clifton nodded. "With the heat, whatever it was they glued the thing to the wall with, let go, and it was lying there on the floor. Charlie Lee said that the rafters were falling and there was fire everywhere and that covering themselves up with the painting was the only thing that saved them."
"Go on."
"When they got out, the CO started screaming at them for not getting the company loving cup or some nonsense, and Charlie Lee started to tell him about the painting, but the piece of shit tells him to shut his nigger mouth and get to policing the area, and Charlie Lee does as he's told and holds the painting away, rolling it up and throwing it in a trash bin. Later that night, he was coming back from taking a shower, and the damn thing was still there, so he took it. And I don't blame him one damn bit."
"He had it all these years?"
"In his closet."
"Where did the smaller painting come from? The proof?" They looked at me blankly. "Never mind about that. You gentlemen are aware that the painting is no longer in Charlie Lee's room, right?" They looked genuinely surprised.
"It's not?"
"No, it's not." I looked at each of them, one by one. "Do any of you have even the slightest idea as to who might have taken it?
Delmar looked at me like I was the fort idiot.
Told you, Russians!
Did any of you actually see Russians take it?
They all looked at one another.
I mean, physically see Russians in here taking it.
They were silent for the first time.
Is there anything else you think you should tell me?
They looked at one another once again and then agreed. Kenny, the first to speak.
No.
If you think of anything more, any of you, will you tell me?
They nodded. I turned and headed back into the main building.
Let's go.
Vic and Carol trailed after, Vic pulling up beside me.
Where?
To make a request with a bullet.
He can be difficult.
I paused.
Is he really deaf-mute?
Carol nodded.
Pretty much.
And how do you communicate with him?
We have a staff member, Diane Morris, who knows sign language, but
is she around?
I doubt it. She generally works nights.
I can sign.
We both stopped on the landing between the stairs, and I turned to look at my undersheriff, who rested her hands on her hips.
What?
You can sign?
Yeah, I learned from the kid who worked the snack shack at the pool, where I lifeguarded every summer back in Philly. I might be a little rusty, but I think I can get the thought across.
I shook my head. Wonders never cease. Sympathy for the devil rattled the door in its frame. Above was a glowing red light that read, On the Air. I looked at Carol.
It's just wired to the lights in his room. Maintenance did it kind of as a joke, but at least you can always tell if he's home or if you need him to answer the door. He's even got a text-to-speech recorder for when he needs to use the phone.
She raised her hand and flipped the light on and off. Nothing happened for a few moments, and then the volume of the music dropped a bit as Carol reflipped the switch.
He's used to us asking him to lower the volume of the music.
She continued flipping the switch, and finally the knob turned and the door opened approximately 3 inches. There was a lot of hair and one luminescent blue eye which stared out at us.
Hi, Mike Bersaw.
Vic ran her tongue over her teeth and smiled a pepsodent smile, making a quick movement with her hands as he continued to stare at her with the one eye. She signed, Can we come in? His hand, decorated with numerous rings and bracelets, the index and middle finger being taped together like a bird's mouth, came out the door as he signed back. Vic, undeterred, made the same gesture and a bit more.
No, really?
She persisted, her hands dancing. We're from the sheriff's department and have a few questions. He didn't respond, but didn't close the door either. I spoke as Vic turned to look at me.
You know, the Stones didn't play the song for 7 years after the stabbing at the Altamont Speedway concert in 69.
She translated, and he opened the door a little more. I began again.
Bobby Kennedy was killed the day Jagger started writing the song, but you probably know that.
She translated, but the door didn't move. Vic stared at him and then joined in singing and signing the chorus.
Woo, woo.
The door swung open a bit and she leaned forward, peered inside, then pushed it open and disappeared. We followed. I went in after Carol and stood there looking at the floor-to-ceiling racks of old 45s.
Good Lord.
There were thousands of records that took up every inch of available wall space, all carefully arranged in the wire racks with labels noting the artists. Fishing nets and tie-dyed fabric covered the ceiling, and incense burned on a sideboard, where an elaborate turntable spun the Stones, 7 more singles stacked above the needle, ready to drop. Magic Mike was nowhere to be seen, but soon returned through a beaded curtain that covered an opening that looked like it had been sledgehammered through the concrete blocks. He was carrying what I assumed to be a cup of tea and handed it to Vic, then he glanced at us. Carol nodded and he disappeared again. I gazed around the room, especially at the psychedelic-looking painted floor with sweeping stars and galaxies. I feel like I just fell into the velvet underground. Carol slipped sideways and looked into the homemade expansion. We may be the only ones who've been in here since the Nixon administration. He returned with 2 more mugs with fluttering tea bags and then gestured toward the 4 beanbag chairs that slouched on the floor. Doing the best I could to leverage myself down, I joined the others as we sat and got a better look at Magic Mike Bersaw. He wore a wool watch cap, his hair, a mottled explosion of black with gray streaks blossoming from under the elastic and trailing over his shoulders and down his back, where it joined with a massive beard of the same color that sprouted out from his face and dropped down to an impressive stomach. He was wearing a pair of brown sweatpants and a faded Hawaiian shirt. Both hands were completely encased in rings and bracelets, and he studied all of us for a moment, but mostly concentrated his attention on Vic. The record changer finished up with the Rolling Stones and dropped Marianne Faithfull's Monday Monday as we sat there drinking tea. Getting Vic's attention, I promoted the line of questioning I wanted to pursue. Ask him if he knows Charlie Lee Stillwater. She made a few quick gestures, and I watched as he responded. Vic said nothing, so I asked, "What did he say?" "He wants to know if we like our tea." "Tell him it's great, but he needs to answer my questions." She translated, and he responded with a quick gesture as my undersheriff turned to look at me. "He wants to know why."
"Why what?"
Carol ventured. "Why answer your questions?"
"No, I suppose, why do we want to know if he knew Charlie Lee Stillwater?"
She made a series of gestures to which he responded, and she made a face. "No, he wants to know why we like the tea. He says he makes it himself from the herb garden in the old chicken shed. He says it's a pu'er, fermented and oxidized." Carol nodded toward the back of the building. "The National Register of Historic Places, chicken shed." I nodded. "Tell him it's the greatest tea I've ever had in my life, which is not much of a stretch." To our surprise, Magic Mike laughed heartily. Carol nodded. "It reads lips pretty well." I sighed, shook my head, and turned back to him. "Did you know Charlie Lee?" He nodded. "Did you know about the painting he had?" He nodded. "Did you help him show it to the waivers?" He nodded again. "And then put it back in the cubby behind the closet where Charlie kept it hidden?" Mike nodded once more. "After he died, it was taken from his room, right?" He shrugged. "Do you have any idea who might have taken it?" He shook his head. "Did you ever see anybody talking or visiting with Charlie Lee who seemed suspicious, people who shouldn't have been around here?" He smiled, finally gesturing, and Vic translated. "You mean the Russians?"
"Possibly."
"Which Russians?" He raised his face, then sipped his tea and signed as Vic translated. "There was one man who was very heavy set, with another who had a head of wild-looking hair, and a woman."
"Blonde? Small, attractive?"
He glanced at Vic and signed. "Not as attractive as me, evidently."
"When did he see them?"
There was a flurry of signing. "Charlie Lee would talk to them on the porch of the administration building, or out where the benches are near the old missiles park." She paused for a moment. "He showed the woman the National Register of Historic Places chicken shed, where he grows the herbs for his tea." He turned back to Vic and gestured some more. "He'd like to know if we'd like to see his chicken coop."
"Maybe some other time."
Dropping the hand signs, she smiled. "Apparently it's pretty unique. He says he captures the rainwater in a cistern and uses that for a gravity-fed irrigation system." Carol nodded. "It's quite a layout."
"I'm sure it's very interesting."
Vic watched him sign some more. "He says the chicken manure makes for a very rich soil content."
"I'm sure."
I put the mug on the floor. "Mike, when were the Russians here last?" He gestured, and Vic spoke. "The woman and the man with the hair were here about a month ago, and then the fat guy showed up asking some questions about a week ago. He showed him the historic chicken coop."
"The heavyset guy, Serge Bushirov, did he seem nervous or anything?"
"He answered in the negative."
"Somebody killed him this morning."
"He didn't seem surprised by the news."
"Yep. And it would appear that the guy with the hair, Count von Lehmann, is also dead."
He said nothing.
"You don't have anything to say about that?"
Not so surprisingly, he remained silent.
"You seem kind of involved in all this."
He took a moment to respond with his hands as Vic spoke. "Not really. He says he just knew Charlie Lee and helped him when he needed it, that's all. Not against the law, is it?"
"It was about then that I fought the law and the law won, dropped onto the turntable, the 45 catching traction as the needle fell."
"Nope."
I studied him and Vic signed my words. "You're sure the woman was with Serge about a week ago?" He took his time, his face hidden in all the hair, and then stared at me and slowly nodded. I stood and looked at the record spinning. That singer, Bobby Fuller, died in 66, overcome by gasoline fumes from an open gas can in his unlocked car, no keys in the ignition. His body was covered in bruises, and he was soaked in fuel, a number of his fingers broken. The L.A. County coroner ruled his death a suicide, but then 3 months later they changed the cause of death to accidental asphyxiation. I moved toward the door as the women joined me. Personally, I think the record label mob connections were responsible, and they were getting ready to torch the car with Fuller in it when they got interrupted. Persaud still sat, looking up at me, and signing as Vic spoke. "And you're telling me this because?" The two women joined me at the door as I ushered them out, and then turned to look back at Magic Mike. "It's a big, dangerous world out there, and it's important to have friends. By the way, I know you're the one who called Bass Townsend and informed him that his grandfather was dead." I turned the doorknob in my hand and slowly closed the door behind us as the song played on. Chapter 14. When we arrived back at the office, Barrett was sitting on my dispatcher's counter. He was reading a copy of Outdoor Life with his hiking boots on Ruby's desk. I stopped at the top of the stairs. "What the hell are you doing here?" He looked up from his magazine. "It's Friday."
"It is?"
"Yep." He stared at me as Vic joined us, and I turned to her.
"Is it Friday?"
"All day."
"Nobody tells me these things."
I turned back to the kid. "One of your jobs is going to be telling me what day it is."
"It's Friday."
"You only have to do it once a day."
"Got it."
"Get your feet off Ruby's desk." Starting toward my office, I muttered, "What time is it? Am I responsible for that, too?"
"Sometimes.
This job is far more wide-ranging than I thought." I glanced up at Seth Thomas on the wall above the old fireplace and noted it was 2 minutes before 5 p.m.
"Ruby leave early?"
"Wow, 2 minutes before the hour is early around this place?" Vic nodded. "We run a tight ship." Barrett lowered his feet and stood, then walked around the counter, and I had my first look at him in the uniform of the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department. I had to admit, the kid looked pretty sharp. "You know, you don't have to wear that when you're dispatching, right?"
"Yeah."
He glanced at himself. "I kind of like it. Helps to remind me that the job is real." I tried to hide the smile as best I could. "The thrill of the badge is what we used to call it, but it can get heavy after a while."
"I'm kind of enjoying it."
He actually polished his star with a cuff. "Ruby said I was doing so well that she was going home."
"5 minutes early?"
"Yeah, it's not much in the way of confidence, but it's something." I continued to head to my office. "I'm sure you'll be fine." He followed us, making it as far as the doorway, where he hung an arm. Vic occupied the guest chair and propped her boots on the edge of my desk. He glanced at her. "How come she gets to put her feet up on the desks?"
"'Cause I do what I want, meat."
"Meat?
As in rookie or new meat."
He folded his arms and leaned on the door jamb.
"When do I stop being meat? When you cease being a liability. Of course, for some guys, that can be a fucking career."
She glanced up at him. "Now go away. The real cops want to talk." He sighed and looked at me.
"One more thing. I was wondering if there was anything else I can do. I mean, there are long times and I'm just sitting out here."
"Not like TV, is it?" I studied him with a smile. "They also serve who only stand and wait." He stared at me. "John Milton, Sonnet 19. He continued to stare at me. "There's a department library out there in the main office. I suggest you continue your reading.
Or badge polishing."
Vic flipped her fingers at him in dismissal, one in particular. Shaking his head, he swung away with a smile. I lowered my voice. "Kind of hard on the kid, weren't you?"
"Not really."
She turned to look at me. "So, how'd you know it was Mike that called Bass?" "Bass said the man had a mechanical voice and that he had simply stated that Charlie Lee was dead and hung up, something a man who was deaf would do, being incapable of hearing the person on the other end." I raised my face and turned a bit, looking out the window. "I have an undercover operation in mind, but it needs to be done under the cover of darkness, so we have to do something else for a while."
"Like?"
"Well, we could go check on Bass Townsend and Contrita, at the Absaroka County Sheriff's Annex over at the Blue Gables Motel. Deal. Suddenly remembering something, I shouted out to the new dispatcher trainee, "Hey, Barrett, where's my dog?" He appeared in the doorway with the dog at his feet. "Is this one of my responsibilities, too?" Bess Townsend and Katrina DeJean were enjoying iced coffees while sitting in the metal lawn chairs at the Blue Gables Inn. I climbed out of the vehicle and headed for the office. Vic called after me, "Where are you going?" "To get a cup of coffee to wash out my taste buds from that horrible tea." "Get me a cappuccino, please. My mouth tastes like ass." When I got back, Bass was strumming the old resonator guitar in his lap and softly singing an Elmore James tune, "Dust My Broom." "How do you feel?" He smiled and looked up at me as I handed Vic her fancy coffee. "Pretty good. I've just been sitting around here entertaining this fine young lady." I glanced at Katrina before taking off the top of my cup and sipping. "And you?" Her smile was a little less enthusiastic. "I'm here." "We need to talk." "Okay." "Preferably alone." She glanced at the others and then back at me. "Yes, sir." I led the way back to my truck. Vic began talking with Bass as he continued to strum. Flipping the tailgate down on my truck, I gestured for Katrina to sit. "Welcome to my office."
"Nice view."
Having a little trouble, she handed me her coffee and sidled up, looking around as I handed it back.
"How can I help you?"
I sat next to her. "I've been talking to the boys up at the Soldiers and Sailors Home, and there's an individual who claims Serge came by no more than a week ago." She looked surprised. "Who says that?" "Never mind for the moment. Do you think it's true?" She started to speak, but then stopped, finally breathing out the word,
"Yes."
She sipped her coffee. "If something were to happen to Philippe, I can only surmise that Serge was under orders to retrieve the painting, or maybe he was after it for himself. Someone broke into Charlie Lee's apartment at the veteran's home." She shrugged. "If it was broken into, I can only surmise that Serge did it. If he was released from the Sheridan County Jail yesterday, and as near as DCI can tell, he was killed only hours later, it would have been kind of difficult for him to get over here and break into Charlie Lee's room in that amount of time." I shook my head. "Let's say he did it the night before. What would he have done with it? If he had found the painting, then he would have taken it for himself or someone else. Someone like Clover Puskov?" She looked slightly shaken at the thought.
"I hope not."
"Why?" She put her empty coffee cup on the tailgate. "Well, then, it's gone." "Not necessarily. I spoke with him on the phone an hour ago, and he's turning his plane around in Helsinki and coming back." I shrugged. "If our runway is long enough." She looked stunned. "Why would he do that?" I was kind of wondering about that myself. I turned to look at her more closely. "Do you suppose he has the painting?"
"It's possible."
"Then why would he come back?" "Perhaps he left the painting in Helsinki?" "Nope, I made a call and spoke with the ground security of the private section of the airport, and they assured me that nothing came off the plane and the only things that were brought on board were paperwork, food, and fuel. Maybe he thinks he can still get the painting now that Philippe and Serge are dead." "Maybe." I waited, but she said nothing. "Which means that whoever has the painting is in danger if Klavdiy Krovopuskov is as capable as I'm led to believe." I waited a moment before adding, "You don't get a name like the Bloodletter for nothing." She turned away, studying the distance. "I don't know where the painting is." I continued to study her. "Okay, I believe you. But who does?" Her head dropped. "The only two people I know of who could have had such knowledge are dead. And in all honesty, those two unsolved murders are the priority for me." I sipped my now cold coffee. "I think they are connected with the painting, and if I find it, it might give me more to work with as far as finding the murderer." I put my empty coffee cup down. "Let me pose a hypothetical. If Serge had gotten the painting, where would he have put it?"
"I honestly don't know."
"Where was he living? mostly at Philippe's.
In Sori?
Yes. If it's hidden in that place, would you have any idea where it might be?
Philippe had a hidden vault in the basement with a combination lock.
Do you know the combination?
I do.
I glance up at the road leading north out of town, toward the tiny hamlet.
So, would you like to take a ride to Sori?
She turned back to meet me, eye to eye.
No.
I just want to go on record as saying that this is a really fucking bad idea, and when I think something is a really bad fucking idea, it is a really fucking bad idea. I glance at my undersheriff as we took the Sori exit off I-90. Duly noted. A quick reminder, I am the patron saint of really fucking bad ideas.
Agreed.
We should tell Sheriff Brandis that we're over here. She shook her head. You remember him, the guy you said you'd keep in the loop?
Hitting the straightaway, I resisted the temptation to flip on the emergency lights. After all, we were, for all intents and purposes, undercover.
Right. But we're not?
No.
Might I ask why?
I already did.
You did what?
Called someone.
A parked Suburban flashed its lights at us as I pulled in alongside the Sheridan County Sheriff's investigator's vehicle.
Howdy.
The silver-haired woman fixed her blues on me.
Don't you howdy me, you outlaw.
Thanks for doing this, Lori. She gestured one-handedly with an air of futility.
May end my career.
We just want to take a look, and I didn't want to trouble your boss. Even though my sheriff specifically requested that you trouble him with anything concerning this investigation? I made a point of not glancing at Vic. Something like that. She pulled out and we followed, accelerating along the creek as I finally turned to glance at Vic, who sat there smiling to herself.
No comment?
Yeah. She's about as batshit crazy as you are. And here we are on our way to the batshit crazy cave.
Lori turned into the circular drive at the end of the road, and I'm pretty sure we were all surprised to find some lights on in the back part of the house.
That's odd.
Vic sat forward, peering through the windshield.
Sheridan SD could have left the lights on.
Or DCI.
We both got out with our guns drawn. Lori joined us at the front of her vehicle, her Colt Python in her hands.
Weird, huh?
I moved toward the house.
Let's go.
The front entrance was blocked with police line tape, which I ducked under before pushing the latch and slowly swinging the unlocked door open. The lights were off in the great hall of the stone building, but in the direction of the kitchen the light spilled out onto the uneven flagstone floor. Stepping forward, I allowed my backup to enter and look around as I held a finger to my lips and continued across the room before running into a heavy lamp that tipped over and crashed to the floor with a tremendous amount of noise. In the silence that followed, Vic's voice carried through the darkness.
So do we still have to be quiet?
Lori snickered, and I continued toward the kitchen door, swung it wide, and looked into the room lit by a single light that hung over the center island. The DCI tape still cordoned off certain areas, and the room looked exactly as it had when I'd been here last, with the exception of the things the investigators must have hauled off for further analysis, not including the half-finished sandwich and glass of milk.
Maybe they ran when they heard you rearranging the furniture.
I sighed. You have that piece of paper that shows how to get to the vault.
I do, O great leader, Lori snickered again as Vic, tiptoeing toward the library conservatory in the back, pulled a piece of paper from her pocket and unfolded it.
Giving one last glance at the crime scene, I had a niggling feeling, but not being able to discern what was causing it, sighed again and followed the two women.
Vic approached one of the bookcases and then consulted the sheet of paper before reaching up and pulling a hidden lever that caused the 8-foot insulation to make a noise and bump out about 3 inches.
Wow! Now this is getting to be like a real mystery.
Reaching over, I pulled the side of the case and pivoted it open like a door as fluorescent lights kicked on in a concrete stairwell that led to a metal doorway below.
All right, who's staying up here?
Lori shrugged. I might as well, that way if anybody shows up I've got an actual reason to be here.
I gestured for Vic to go ahead. After you, my dear Alphonse. She smiled, and then led with the midnight bronze Glock 19 Gen 4. There was nothing particularly interesting about the steps, walls, or ceiling. But as we got closer to the door, we could see the thing was securely anchored into the walls with a heavy steel facing and an electronic keypad where a knob should have been. Vic consulted the paper and then tapped in the numbers. The keypad lit up and then beeped at us. "What does that mean?" She glanced at me and then pushed the door open, the automatic lights flickering to life inside.
"After you, Alphonse."
Stepping around her, I nudged the heavy door back and looked in. The basement vault must have run a quarter of the length of the house with shelves of canvases in the awakening lights. Holy frijoles! Vic stepped in beside me and held up a hand to feel the air. I'm guessing temperature and humidity controlled. We moved a little closer to the stacks, and I could see that none of the paintings were actually finished. What in the world? Turning, I approached an area where there were numerous easels and painting supplies, and you could see more works of unfinished art. It's a factory. Vic came over, holstering her sidearm.
Fakes?
Yep, and very good ones. I stood. But who? Serge didn't strike me as the artistic type. Turning, I looked past an examination table not unlike the one at the Bradford Brinton and could see a cot and blankets near the wall, along with a bottle of water, a towel, and a half mug of tea. Somebody's been staying here. Kneeling, I felt the mug. Cold. Vic joined me. Serge? Possibly. Walking back to the door, I got a hold of that niggling thought and called up to the Sheridan County investigator. "Hey, Laurie?" Her voice echoed down. "Yeah? Do me a favor and check and see if that sandwich in the kitchen is fresh and if the glass of milk is cold. Be right back." I turned to Vic. "Habeas corpus. Count Philipp von Lehmann? We never found a body, just blood and prints, and I find it hard to believe that the Count would have given Serge the combination to this vault." She glanced around. "What if Serge killed him? Still no body." "You really think he killed Serge?" "I don't know." She shrugged. "Klavdiy Kropotkin? A lot of those Russian oligarchs are buying up this Soviet-era art and repatriating it, and I'm guessing that the Count found a way to sell the fakes back to the Russians." I glanced at the enormous collection. Laurie's voice called from above. "Sandwich is fresh, and the milk is cold." I moved toward the door. "Somebody's here. No joke." She suddenly appeared in the doorway with someone behind her, who nudged her forward into the room with us as he stayed in the doorway. "He got the jump on me." He aimed the pistols on us. "Sorry about all this, but you haven't left me many choices." Laurie purposefully moved in front of Vic as my undersheriff slipped a hand down by his sidearm. I stepped in the other direction. "Maybe you'd like to tell us what's going on here, Count?" He looked a little worse for wear and tipped his head, the fluff of hair swaying to the side as he stood there in his bathrobe and slippers. "I know this is where the guilty party usually doles out the details of his dastardly plan, but I'm sorry to disappoint you in that I'm completely innocent." I stepped forward. "Funny, from here you don't look it." He shook his head and reached out to close the door. "Look, I'm not going to shoot any of you if I don't have to. That's what you call innocent?" Leaning against the door, he placed more of it between us, only his head, gun hand, and foot showing. "I didn't hurt anybody." "Then explain to me what's going on. If you're truly innocent, then you have nothing to fear from me." He barked a laugh. "You're not the one I'm worried about, trust me." "Then who?" "I'm sorry to cut this short, but I'm afraid I have to go." "What, you have to get back in your coffin before the sun comes up?" He and I both turned to see Vic with her arm outstretched, the 9mm leveled at the Count's head. "Drop the gun, fucktard." He paused for an instant. "I can't. Then we play catch with lead." He slammed his shoulder into the door as she fired. The door closed with a thud, all three of us there in an instant trying to pry the thing open. I turned to Vic. "Quick, the combination." We could hear screaming and a litany of profanity from the other side. "Fuck, fuck, 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 fuck." She pulled the paper from the back of her jeans. "I think I got him. Fuck, 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 fuck." Laurie listened at the door. "Too bad you didn't get him in the mouth." "Fuck!" Vic punched the numbers into the keyboard and we waited. But nothing happened. She consulted the piece of paper again and punched the numbers in once more, but still nothing happened. He must have jammed it. I called into the door. Philippe, can you hear me? Fuck! Look, open the door and we'll get you some help. Fuck! A bullet wound is a very serious injury, and we'll need to get you to a hospital. Look, if you're really innocent, we can help you. There was whimpering, but nothing more from the other side. Philippe? What? Where are you hit? My foot! The bitch shot off my big toe! I glanced at her, and she shrugged. I was trying to keep him alive. I spoke into the door again. Is there a lot of blood? My toe is gone, and I'm bleeding to death out here. There was silence for a moment. You bitch! Why did you shoot me? She tapped the barrel on the metal door. Fuck you, asshole! In about a minute, I'm going to start throwing rounds through this door, and it ain't going to be your toe this time. I bit my lip. Philippe, open the door. No! Lori pulled out her cell phone. As much as it grieves me, I guess I'd better call the boss. I spoke into the door again. Philippe, we're going to have to call someone. There's no service down here. Fuck! Really? My toe? Lori glanced up. He's right. No bars. These were brand new slippers! Philippe, just open the door and sit down, and we'll do something to stop the bleeding. Standing on it is only going to make it worse. There was some indiscernible mumbling. Philippe? Nothing. Vic reholstered her weapon. It's a solid door, and I don't think the 9mm would go through. I looked around. Well, he can't get far on one foot. Lori peered up and down the aisles of half-finished artwork. Raising her phone, she started off. I'll check and see if I can get reception anywhere down here. I glanced at Vic. Maybe we can find another door or something. We started off, each going to the perimeter and walking the length of the subterranean room. At the far end we met, trading off and switching directions until we headed in opposite paths up the aisles. The amount of faux art was stunning. The variation in styles and subject matter no less so. Whoever had been manufacturing the stuff had been doing it for some time and had been very thorough in their reproductions. Walt? I walked quickly down the aisle and peered through an opening where Vic stood. She pointed. Air vent. Big enough to get through? For me. What if it's just the heating and cooling? She shrugged. Might still lead out of the basement. We need a screwdriver. There were tools on that work table, and a ladder by the wall. T-25 Torx. I handed the bit up to her and watched as she put it in the battery-powered drill. Who knew you were this handy? Four brothers and a father back in Philadelphia who thought you were slave labor until you escaped. How did you escape? Took the Nelson Denny reading test for the police department. She unscrewed the last batch and used a chisel that was in her other hand to pry the metal. Watch your head. The thing came loose and crashed to the concrete floor between me and Lori. You're lucky you have a skinny undersheriff. We watched as she pulled out her maglite, shimmied her way into the duct, and climbed out of sight. It's a long run to the end of the room, and then it goes up, I think. I'll know better when I get there. We listened as she thumped along in the duct, following her progress, until we got to the wall where the door was, and she paused. It's a reach, so I'll just have to climb up it to see where it goes next. Standing there, waiting, we listened to the thumping and banging as she made her way out of our hearing. Lori folded her arms and leaned against the door jamb. So, you think he did it? No, he's a nuisance, but I don't think he's a killer. Then who is? Good question. The interesting thing is that he stored up his own blood and faked the murder, so who the heck was he so afraid of? This Klavdiy Krovopuskov? Maybe. She leaned against the wall. Have you met this guy? Once. Over in Cody. And? He didn't strike me as a killer, but then I've been wrong before. She laughed. When? There was a loud noise from upstairs, a noise great enough to carry through the house and down the concrete stairwell to us. Were those gunshots? Sure sounded like it. We both placed an ear against the door, but there was nothing more. Okay, if we don't hear anything in the next couple of minutes, as much as I dread the thought, I'm going to have to go up in the ventilator shaft. Lori shrugged. I'm smaller than you. I stepped back, glancing down the corridor just as all the lights in the place went out. Well, hell. It's going to be hard to find that ventilator duct in the dark. No, wait. There's somebody coming down the stairs. Placing an ear against the door, I could hear someone's footfalls on the concrete. Vic? The keypad began beeping as someone began punching the numbers, and after a moment, the door bumped open into the side of both our heads as the lights flickered back on. Vic swung the door the rest of the way and looked at Lori.
I hope that wasn't a brand new Suburban you were driving.
Chapter 15. You sure there was someone else in the vehicle with him?
Positive. Believe me, he wasn't driving without that missing toe.
There was blood all over the place, dribbling up the steps and across the den, kitchen, and through the dining area into the main room where he must have stopped to talk quickly with someone. He'd continued through the door onto the front lawn, where we now stood, watching the sprinkler system in the side yard making halos in the overhead lights.
Well, there's no way out of it now.
I turned to Lori. However you want to phrase it, we need an APB on your vehicle. I watched as she pulled out her phone and dialed 911. I'll tell him I had an inkling and was having dinner over at the wagon box with you guys and asked you to back me up. That is, if I even tell them you were here at all. She shrugged. What's the whippersnapper going to do, fire me? She held the phone to her ear. I was supposed to retire, and I'm the highest decorated officer on Six Week Wonder's staff. Let him try. She spoke into the phone. Hi, Terry, it's Lori, and yes, I've got an emergency. Actually, what I've got is an interesting situation involving Grand Theft Auto. She wandered away as I looked back at Vic. Any ideas who it was?
Hard to tell with those tall headrests, even with the interior lights on.
Man? Woman?
Who knows?
She turned and looked down the road, holstered her weapon, and placed hands on hips.
What are they after?
The Custer painting. She continued walking around as if she were looking for something.
You sure?
It's the only thing that makes any sense. The Count is sitting on a bunch of fake Russian artwork, and the only potential buyer for something that big is on his way back from Helsinki in his private jet. She nodded, but continued inspecting the lawn.
Somebody really just wants that painting.
Lori reappeared. My guys are on the way, so you guys better scoot.
We can't just leave you here.
Sure you can. Look, this place is going to be crawling with Sheridan SD in a matter of moments. Besides, they can give me a ride home. She punched my arm.
Go catch some bad guys.
Thanks, Lori. She called after us as I moved toward my truck, Vic still checking the ground.
Make sure they spell my name right in the paper.
I sat in the truck for a moment and thought about what could have driven Philippe von Lehmann to fake his own murder. Who could he have been trying to frame? I buckled up and fired the 10-cylinder of the bullet to life as Vic climbed in the other side.
Where the hell do you suppose he thinks he's going to go?
I have no idea.
How can he think he's going to get away?
Once again, I have no idea.
On a private jet, say the one that's winging its way here from Helsinki as we speak?
Seems possible.
So the airport?
No.
Think he'd be stupid enough to go to a hospital?
Not really.
The home?
Slipping the truck into gear, I pulled out of the wooded area and back onto the main road leading south at a brisk pace.
You know, if we were in my new truck, we could go faster.
Uh-huh.
I glanced at her. You mind if I ask what you were looking for in the Count's yard? She pointed up her index finger like a barrel and blew away the imaginary gun smoke.
The toe, of course. I'm going to need a keychain for my new truck.
It was late as we pulled into town. I took the north exit, drove down the main drag, and glanced toward the Blue Gables, hoping to possibly see a silver Suburban with bullet holes in the back.
So what kind of damage did you do to the Chevrolet?
Not enough to keep it from running, obviously. She shrugged. Took out the back window and one in the rear door, so I don't think I got either of them, if that's what you're asking.
No, I was hoping the vehicle would break down.
Slowing, I looked around the parking lot, but the place appeared to be buttoned up and slumbering.
So Bass says he's supposed to look in the safe deposit box first thing on Monday morning.
Then what?
I think he's planning on heading back to Los Angeles.
With $1 million?
I'd imagine.
Well, I wish him luck.
What did Nikita have to say about the painting?
I glanced at her.
Katrina said that the Count had made arrangements with Charlie Lee to buy the Custer painting and had even paid him. But then the old guy had died. Do you think the Count was the one who broke into Charlie Lee's room in an attempt to find it?
No, I don't think he's up for those kinds of clandestine operations.